Let's go ahead and begin chapter 2. As I say, this is perhaps the most significant chapter in the book. It may not be the most exciting, but it's significant in the sense that everything we know about astronomy, we know because of the light or the radiation that we see. So that story we need to cover tonight. And there are four issues in particular I want to cover. What is light? The development of spectroscopy, the Bohr model of the atom, and the Doppler effect. And in each case, what is the significance of each of these four issues to our study of astronomy? Let's go ahead and begin by looking at our first topic, and that's the nature of light. And why do we want to study light? Well, because, as I say, almost everything we know about the universe comes from it, from what we see. And since the 19th century, and we'll look at this story later tonight, we can extract so much data from the light that we do see coming from the universe that we can learn many things about the objects that we're viewing because of the light they're emitting. Just a massive amount of information is raining down upon us continually. It was unknown, undetected by humanity up until the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. But now that we understand the process of extracting that data, it is absolutely phenomenal what we can learn. The ancient world had absolutely no clue what light was. There are many theories, most of them based on conjecture and superstition. Two theories during the Middle Ages into the Renaissance began to emerge as to the nature of light. And the first was that light must be a stream of particles. And the second theory was that light was a wave. And there were proponents for each of these. Isaac Newton in the 17th century came up with what he called the corpuscular theory of light. He believed light was a stream of particles. He had three reasons for this, two or three reasons. Number one, he pointed out that light does not bend around a corner like sound waves do. So if somebody's standing outside your room, down the hall, you can speak to that person. They can hear you. Sound waves go around corners. Light doesn't. You can't see that person. Pretty simple experiment. Audible waves, sound waves, do bend around corners. And furthermore, waves need a medium to be transmitted, like water or air. And in space, it's a virtual vacuum. How can a wave be propagated? So those were the basic arguments that Newton used to conclude that light must be a stream of particles rather than a wave. It just doesn't exhibit enough wave-like properties, but rather almost exclusively particle qualities. And because of the reputation of Newton, his theory was the dominant one up until the mid-19th century, 300 years. He, by the way, had no idea what caused light. He was just explaining what he thought that it was. And now the next person in our story is the Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell, 1831 to 1879, who, in my opinion, is probably the greatest scientist since Isaac Newton. What do we have to thank this guy for? Cell phones, pagers, TV remote controls, internet Wi-Fi, and on it goes. All of these devices are based on Maxwell's equations. He noted that atomic particles have electric charges, positive or negative, and that they're all in motion. He also knew that charges in motion produce a magnetic field, and that moving magnetic fields produce electric charges, which in turn produce electric fields. So he comes up with the conclusion that magnetic and electric fields are self-propagating transverse fields at right angles to each other. One creates the other, which creates the other ad infinitum. And that's his explanation of light. It's a wave-like phenomenon consisting of these transverse, self-propagating electric and magnetic fields. Each one produces the other. Here's an illustration of how this works. H is the designation for magnetic wave, E for electric wave. One produces the other. All of this is triggered by those oscillating electric charges in atoms. Again, electric charges in motion produce the magnetic fields, which in turn produce the electric fields as well. they all move out like a wave, like a finger touching a calm pond at the speed of light in all directions. And he called light electromagnetic radiation. Again, electromagnetic, coming from the electric and magnetic fields, self-propagating. Anything that moves produces electromagnetic radiation. Atoms, people, stars. Your body right now is producing electromagnetic radiation. We can't see it, but if we were to turn the lights out and we had an infrared sensor, each one of you would light up like a light bulb. But the human eye cannot detect infrared radiation, so we don't see that. Only at absolute zero does radiation cease, because there's no, by definition, there's no motion, no movement, even at the atomic level. A possible and mysterious exception is the concept of dark matter that we'll return to in a later chapter. Matter that we believe exists because of its gravitational forces that it exerts, but matter that we cannot see. So again, to review, Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, the classical theory of light as a wave-like self-propagating electronic and magnetic fields. He also determined that light is one of several forms of electromagnetic radiation, and this is very important. The visible light that we see is a tiny sliver of a much broader spectrum of radiation. He also determined that the velocity of all forms of radiation is the speed of light, designated as C, as in E equals mc squared. V equals C for all forms of electromagnetic radiation. His four equations, simple equations, contain his theory of light. They're so simple they can be placed on a t-shirt and have been. One of the most spectacular achievements in science in the 19th century was the Maxwell description of light. But by the early 20th century, certain anomalies with the wave theory of electromagnetic radiation begin to emerge, including the mysterious photoelectric effect. And the idea here was this was known, you know, by the latter part of the 19th century, that if you had a sheet of metal and you shined a bright light on it, it would cause a current to flow in the metal, because those electrons were absorbing some of the energy from that incoming light. But it was also known that certain color lights had different effects. For example, red light, no matter how intense the beam, would cause no current to move in that metal plate. Whereas a very low luminosity blue light would instantly cause electrons to move and current to move. Well, experimenters started making the red light more and more intense. No matter how intense you made it, 1,000 times more intense than the blue light, it would not move electric current in the plate. That's not how a wave would act. If light was a wave and you shone that very intense red light beam on that plate, the more intense, the greater the wave effect and the more current you would achieve. That's not how it was. And it was not understood what was causing this strange phenomenon until Albert Einstein, in 1905, publishes a paper on the photoelectric effect where he explains what is happening. That year, 1905, Einstein was about 26 years old, I think, and he published four papers, any one of which deserved a Nobel Prize, not just on the photoelectric effect, for which he did win the Nobel Prize in 1921, but also his paper on special relativity. His third paper was on Brownian motion. How do you account for a glass of water into which you insert a drop of food coloring and watch the motion? He explained it. And the fourth one is on the energy mass equivalence, E equals mc squared. So those are the four papers. But the paper for which he received the Nobel Prize was on the photoelectric effect. And his conclusion was this: the only way to account for that bizarre phenomenon on that metal plate is that light is not a wave, but rather is a series of particles he called photons that are transmitting energy at different levels. And red light, obviously, it consists of photons of a certain frequency or wavelength that are not, they don't have enough energy to move the electrons in that plate and cause a current. Whereas the blue light is much more energetic. And as we'll see, that is exactly right. That was received with mixed reviews. Most scientists rejected it because it was so contrary to the Maxwellian idea of light as a wave. Einstein was doing nothing less than rejecting the wave theory of electromagnetic radiation. Maxwell's theory was later revised by quantum mechanics, such as the photoelectric effect, that light sometimes behaves like particles or photons, but that is not to diminish the fact that light also acts as a wave sometimes. And so there emerged what physicists called the wave-particle duality, that light has characteristics of both particles and waves. However, both of these characteristics cannot be detected simultaneously. Now, let's talk about waves just in general. And there are many kinds of waves, not just electromagnetic radiation, but waves that we see in water or other media, for example. All of them have four properties. They have a wavelength. That's the difference between two crests of a wave. Waves have frequency. That refers to how many waves pass a certain point per second, and that is referred to as a hertz. One hertz is one wavelength passing one point per second. Waves have speed, and they have intensity or energy. Now, let's take a look at these. The first one is wavelength. That's the distance between crests. The human eye perceives different wavelengths of visible light as different colors. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. The Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. The red, as it turns out, are longer wavelengths of radiation. The other end, the blue, indigo, and violet, are much shorter wavelengths of light. Our eye perceives the different wavelengths as different colors. The second characteristic of a wave is its frequency. That's how many times it passes the same point per second. A megahertz, you see that, or kilohertz on radio dials, referring to thousands, millions, or gigahertz, billions of hertz per second. Waves have speed. Velocity of a wave, of any wave, is its wavelength, distance between two crests, times its frequency. You multiply those two variables, and you will have the velocity of the wave. That's true for a wave in the ocean. That's true for a wave in a bathtub. And that's true for electromagnetic radiation. The difference is this, that for electromagnetic radiation of all kinds, C, the speed of light, is the velocity. And that's helpful because in any type of radiation, the wavelength times the frequency must equal the speed of light, roughly 186,000 miles per second or 300,000 kilometers per second. So different kinds of radiation differ only in frequency and wavelength, not in velocity. That's a very important point. And just think how significant that is. If different forms of radiation travel at different speeds, how could we even begin to study objects in astronomy? You'd never know how far they were, depending on what kind of radiation we were looking at. So basically, waves of a shorter wavelength have greater frequency so that they equal the speed of light, whereas waves of longer wavelength must have a lower frequency to get the speed of light as the product of the frequency and the wavelength. Also, you have intensity. The energy of any type of electromagnetic radiation is Planck's constant times the frequency of that radiation. So what that means is, obviously, and Planck's constant, we don't have to remember what it is, it's something like 10 to the minus 34th power, it's a very small number, that multiplied times frequency equals the energy of a photon. So even though all photons, or particles of light, are traveling at the same speed, some have greater or lesser energy depending on the frequency. And the higher the frequency multiplied by that constant, Planck's constant, the higher the energy. So what are the higher energy photons or types of light? In terms of visible light, it's blue. That has more energy than red. That's why blue light, even very faint blue light, moved current in the plate. Red light did not. You know, one way to think about this is looking at a race between an elephant and a mouse, for example. Maybe not a race, maybe they're running together. And let's say they're both going at 1 mile per hour. The elephant has a very long stride. That's its wavelength. And very low frequency. The legs are moving slowly. So it's kind of a low energy form of propulsion. Whereas the mouse going 1 mile an hour, those little legs are invisible. They're moving so fast. So a very small wavelength, very high frequency, very high energy. Similar to photons. And here we see different types of radiation and radio waves, infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. And as the wavelength here increases, going up this column, the frequency has to decrease and vice versa so that the product of these two factors equals the speed of light. So if you look at radio waves, these are the longest wavelength. Here it's 10 to the second meter. That's only 100 meters. Some of these are up to 20 million miles in wavelength, the longest radio waves. And you multiply that number times frequency to equal the speed of light, and that's why you see this direct correlation here. As the wavelength increases, the frequency decreases, so that the product of the two is constant for each form of radiation. Very important point. Now, let's talk about how we can measure the speed of light. This is an interesting experiment in a microwave oven. And yes, we go back to our equation here. The speed of light equals the wavelength times frequency. And if you look at the inside door of a microwave oven, there's a little plate there that by law has to list the frequency of that microwave oven. Very common to see 2.4, 2.5 gigahertz, okay? 2.4 to 2.5 billion wavelengths going by the same point per second. Now, that's the frequency. What's the wavelength? If we knew that, we could measure the speed of light. And you can measure that with a chocolate bar and two toothpicks. And what you do is take a Hershey's large chocolate bar and put it in the microwave and turn it on for 20 seconds or so until hot spots start to appear. Does the microwave heat that chocolate uniformly, the entire bar? No. There are hot spots in there. And what are those? They're the troughs and the peaks of the waves coming through. They're microwave radiation. In between the troughs and the peaks, it's kind of a null area. There's no heating. That's why if you put ants in the microwave and turn it on for 60 seconds, what happens? They don't burn up. They go to the cool areas. The will to live. Have you ever done that? You put something in the microwave. Why didn't this heat up? You had it in a cold spot. You didn't have it in the trough or the peak of the microwave. And that's why some of them have those twirling plates. Okay. Now, how do you determine the wavelength? You look at that chocolate bar after 10 or 20 seconds, and you probe with the toothpicks, and you find the hot spot is melted. And you put one toothpick there, you find another one, you put one there. What have you just measured? Half the distance of a wave. You've gone from a trough to a peak. You multiply that distance times 2, which is about 8 inches, as it turns out, as I recall. And then you put it in centimeters. And you multiply that times the frequency, and you get a fairly close approximation of the speed of light. Try it in the cafeteria. Do they have microwave ovens in there? Yeah, try that. Do they have big chocolate bars? Man, those are gone fast. But bring one in there. And so, oh, good, you brought candy for us. No, I'm doing a scientific experiment. So here we see the major types of radiation. And this is looking at them in ascending order from left to right of wavelength. So here we have gamma rays. Those are the shortest wavelength type of radiation. In fact, any wavelength that is shorter than X-ray is considered gamma ray. Then you have gamma ray and X-ray and then ultraviolet and then visible. And then, again, go into longer and longer wavelengths. We have infrared. We have microwave radiation. The Wilkinson Anisotropy Telescope took pictures of the heavens and the cosmic background radiation experiment. And it showed from the earliest time in the history of the universe the radiation that the telescope observed was in not the visible light, but in microwave. And this is a classic proof of the expanding nature of the universe. That radiation started out as visible light, but because of the stretching of the universe, it has become microwave radiation. And then VHF, that's very high and ultra-high frequency radio waves and short wave radio waves, and then long-range radio waves. These are the waves that can go out to up to 20 million miles in wavelength. One of the uses of these, by the way, is submarines. Submarine communication uses long-range radio waves. Now, the interesting thing to note is this. Look at these red squiggly lines coming down. Look at gamma ray, X-ray, ultraviolet. They don't make it down to the surface of the Earth, do they? They make it down to about 100 kilometers, about 60 miles above the surface, and that's as far as they penetrate. What does that mean? We can't see that type of radiation from Earth. Now, visible light makes it to the surface. That's why we see stars in the sky and galaxies. Look at infrared. It comes down lower than these high-energy forms of radiation, but it still doesn't come down to the Earth. It drops off somewhere about 50 kilometers. You know, you're looking at 30 miles. And that's why we have high-altitude aircraft that actually are able to do some infrared astronomy, because they're high enough that they're able to capture some of that infrared radiation. The same is actually true at Mauna Kea in Hawaii, where, for example, the Keck and the Gemini telescopes are some of the biggest telescopes in the world. They're able to do some infrared work up there because they're 14,000 feet elevation. Mauna Kea, by the way, is the largest mountain in the world from base to peak. It's just that most of it is below the ocean. Even at 14,000 feet, it's above 98% of the water vapor in the atmosphere. So it's clear up there virtually every night. And, you know, microwave makes it to the surface. VHF, UHF waves make it. This is a very important point. I want you to remember this, because we're going to come back to this in a few minutes, that the high energy, the high frequency, short wavelength forms of radiation over here don't make it to the surface of the Earth. That's a very important point. And it's good that visible light makes it down here, or what would we be seeing at night? Absolute, a black void in space. Okay, now the interesting thing is this. The visual astronomy, what we look at through telescopes, here's the key, reveals only a tiny fraction of the information that's raining down upon us from space. All of the radiation emitted in the form of gamma, X-ray, and ultraviolet rays doesn't make it to the surface of the Earth. We can't see it. We can't detect it. That's true for most forms of infrared radiation. And this is why NASA had the Four Great Observatory program over the last 15 years to put four telescopes in space. The Hubble Space Telescope, we talked about this last week. The Spitzer Infrared Telescope, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, and the Compton Gamma Ray. All of these were orbiting spacecraft. Above the Earth's atmosphere, they could see these forms of radiation and see the universe in a way that was heretofore invisible. So these are all the forms of radiation that don't make it to the Earth's surface. And I just want to impress upon you, it's just amazing when you think about it, how small the segment or the chunk of radiation is that the human eye can detect. It is so insignificant compared to the spectrum of radiation, which goes from gamma rays with a wavelength at the atomic level all the way to those long-range radio waves of up to 20 million miles of wavelength. And in that spectrum of 20 million miles, visible light is all we can see, and that light has a wavelength of about 400 to 700 nanometers. Now, a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. It's also one-tenth of an angstrom. But 400 to 700 nanometers, one nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So we're talking about an exceedingly small wavelength, which is the only wavelength that the human eye can detect. It's hard to visualize this. Let me try this on for size. Let's take a ream of copy paper. Okay, you got 500 sheets. And that ream of 500 sheets is about 2 inches thick. One sheet is about 4/1000th of an inch, or 1/10000th of a meter thick. Now, the width of this sheet is, think about this, is 100 times thicker than all the wavelengths of visible light, 400 to 700 nanometers. That width right there is 100 times wider than all of the wavelengths of the radiation that the human eye is able to see in a spectrum 20 million miles wide. Is that amazing or what? It gets better. Longest radio waves, up to 19 to 20 million miles. Our eyes can only see wavelengths 1/100th the width of a piece of paper in an electromagnetic radiation spectrum millions of miles wide. 20 million miles. That's half the distance to Mars, for example. And what that means is we see about 1/10 quadrillionth of the electromagnetic spectrum. That's what the human eye can see. I talked to a blind individual recently, and I said, you know, Paul, we all are blind, aren't we? We see nothing. Somebody told me once that his favorite color was microwave. And I thought, well, that's really an intelligent response, because it is a color. It's a form of radiation. And he felt that the other colors were more passive. They didn't do anything. They were purely aesthetic. But microwave is a color that works. It heats pizza. Now, look at this. Here we have the Spitzer Radio Space Telescope. Looking at the universe in visible light, now it flips on the infrared camera. And you're looking at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, hidden in dust, obscured to the naked eye. Here it is again, the Spitzer Orbiting Infrared Telescope, looking at the universe in infrared radiation. Information that had never before been observed. Here it is again, looking at the Pinwheel Galaxy in Canis Venatici, M51. Visible, now looking at it in infrared. Here's M81, Bode's Galaxy in Ursa Major. You can see it's highlighting there the what it looks like in infrared versus visible light. Okay, look at the detail that's invisible in invisible light. And here is the entire galaxy. Look at how different it looks. We learn so much more about the structure, the dynamics of objects in space by looking at them from in different types of radiation than we are chained to visible light. Here's the Sombrero Galaxy 104, M104. Visible light switching over to infrared light. So these different perspectives are providing astronomers with just a wealth of information about these objects heretofore unknown. Here's the Pillars of Creation in Serpens in infrared. Again, the infrared radiation largely does not penetrate to the surface of the Earth. We have to have a telescope go up above the atmosphere to see it, just as we did with gamma ray and X-ray. The Hubble Space Telescope is being decommissioned. It's going to be replaced in about 5 years by the James Webb Orbiting Space Telescope, which will be about 200 inches compared to the Hubble 94-inch aperture. So it'll be several times the resolving power. It's going to be predominantly an infrared telescope. So there are not going to be many visible light images it's going to be sending down. It's going to be looking at objects in the infrared part of the spectrum. Now, let's look at a theological application here from 2 Kings chapter 6. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. "My lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered, "for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "Lord, open his eyes so he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. What a great passage of scripture. And when I read this, I think about radiation. And what was going on here? Was this God giving the servant the ability to see the spiritual realm, which is not invisible light? It's in some other type of radiation that's invisible to the human eye. And we see many examples of this in Scripture. And in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, "Now we see but a poor reflection. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." Or Numbers chapter 22, "Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with his sword drawn. So he bowed low and fell face down." But anyway, it's kind of interesting to look at the Bible and see potential applications of what we've just been talking about tonight. This is not in the book, but I thought, you know, it relates directly to what we're talking about in terms of radiation. So I want to mention this. Why is the sky blue? It is a question that evokes bewilderment in the mind of every parent at some point when your five-year-old child asks you that. It's going to happen to you. Mommy or daddy, why is the sky blue? You know, I'll tell you what, that is a difficult question to answer. Very few people can provide an intelligent answer to that question. Let's take a look at it. You'll soon understand why that is so. What a beautiful scene to see blue sky. But it's very different, isn't it, from the surface of the earth than if we would travel a couple hundred thousand miles to our nearest neighbor, the moon. What color is the sky there? Black in broad daylight. No blue sky. What causes the difference? Well, let's go over the factors that account for this. This was first explained by an English physicist by the name of Lord Rayleigh in the latter part of the 19th century. So this, we've only known what caused the sky to be blue for about 100 years. Let's take a look at it. He discovered, and this was known by others, but that particles and molecules tend to scatter incoming light. But what Rayleigh figured out was that particles larger than about one-tenth the wavelength of the incoming light reflect all wavelengths and produce white light. That means that bigger particles reflect all forms of visible light, and when all forms of visible light are reflected, what do you have? You have white light, which is the combination of all of them. That's why when you see a prism, the white light becomes the colors of the rainbow and vice versa. And that explains headlights in a fog. You drive into a fog at night with your lights on, what happens? That whole fog, it's illuminated, isn't it? Like a ball of illumination around your car and in front of you. That's exactly what's happening here. Those are large molecules, those water molecules, and they scatter all forms of light. It's very different in the upper atmosphere. Small particles, smaller than one-tenth the wavelength of the incoming light, like the nitrogen that predominates in the upper atmosphere of Earth, tend to scatter only the shorter wavelengths of light, that's the blue and the violet, not the longer wavelengths of visible light. And in fact, Rayleigh figured out that the degree of scattering is proportional to 1 divided by the wavelength to the fourth power. And you do the math, and what happens is that the shorter the wavelength under that formula, the greater the degree of scattering. The longer the wavelength, the less scattering that occurs. So that's the phenomenon that's taking place, and we see it right in this curve here, Rayleigh scattering. We look at the wavelength, and we look at the percent of scattering. As the wavelength decreases down toward 400 nanometers, look at the scattering, much higher. As it comes down to red, the scattering is much lower. It turns out that the difference between 400 nanometers and 700 nanometers, that's the very blue and very red, is about 9.4 times. So there's almost 10 times more scattering of light, of blue light, than there is of red light, all because its wavelength is so much shorter. And remember I said to remember the gamma, the ultraviolet, and X-ray radiation did not penetrate to the surface of the Earth? You see why now. Those are all very short wavelengths, shorter than blue. They are scattered away in the upper atmosphere and never reach the Earth. And why do we talk about this? It's not relevant just because the sky is blue, but because we see a lot of objects in space that are different colors, such as this picture I took a few months ago of the Pleiades star cluster. And the blue that you see here in this cluster of several dozen stars, some 1,500 light years away, but what causes that blue coloration you see around the stars is Rayleigh scattering. You have hydrogen predominantly particles, very small, smaller than nitrogen. And they're scattering mostly blue light coming through those gaseous clouds. So again, this explains coloration we see in many objects in space. The coloration is a function of the wavelength of the light and the size of the particle. The larger particles reflect and scatter everything, and when you combine all forms of visible light, it's white, and that's driving into a fog at night. So when you drive into that fog at night, and you see the whole cloud illuminated in front of you, it's kind of blinding and disorienting, just remember, that is the same phenomenon that makes the sky blue. And here's another question I thought we'd cover tonight, and that is, can we see the lunar landers on the surface of the moon? You ever wondered about that? We've had 6 manned landings on the moon. Yes? That's a good question. What causes the sunset, the sky to appear reddish or orange? Any ideas? Absolutely, yes. There's more scattering, and what's it scattering? The blue. The shorter waves, yes, and that leaves the longer waves there as we're looking through more of the atmosphere. That's exactly what's happening. That's why objects tend to, like stars, appear to look almost reddish. The moon certainly does when it's closer to the horizon. Same principle, but certainly the sun does as well. Good question. Now, we've had 6 manned landings on the moon. I think they were Apollos 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17 back in the 60s and 70s. And so we have 6 lunar landers there, plus we have a whole series, dozens of unmanned spacecraft that crash-landed, some of them soft-landed, Russian and American. So there's a lot of debris up there. A lot of people, about 25% of the population, doesn't believe that we ever landed on the moon at all. And one of the evidence they give is, why can't we see those landers in a telescope? Why can't the Hubble Space Telescope see some of those landers up there? That proves that we never landed. Well, that's a good question. Why can't we see? This is the lander from Apollo 11, the first manned landing on the surface of the moon, July 1969. One small step for man, one giant step for mankind. We're going to take a look at that recording of that statement in a later lecture, because it's one of the great enigmas in the history of lunar explanation. What did Neil Armstrong mean when he said that? It's a nonsensical sentence, isn't it? One small step for man, one giant step for mankind. In both phrases, he's referring to the human race collectively. So how can he say it's small and great at the same time? Armstrong insists that he said that what he was supposed to say, well, this is the argument, what he was supposed to say on his script was, one small step for a man, one giant step for mankind. Now, that transforms it, doesn't it? That has sense and meaning. And that he flubbed his line reading it into the microphone. You ever done that? It's the risk you take in public discourse. And he insists to this day he read his lines correctly. You think he would memorize that much, wouldn't you? Any of you actors or actresses? That'd be a pretty easy line to remember, wouldn't it? One small step for a man, but a great step for mankind. And it's transposed into a small step for man and a giant step for mankind. We'll listen to the tape recording maybe next week, and you can judge for yourself if he was correct in saying. And by the way, NASA just hired a forensic company to analyze that recording and decide this issue one way or the other. And we'll let you be the jury if I remember to do that next week. If not next week, it'll be in an upcoming class. But this is where it took place. This is where he was reading his lines, right here in his little home on the surface of the moon. Now, it turns out that there's something called Dawes' Limit, which is a geometrically derived mathematical equation that tells us the resolving power of any telescope. And according to Dawes' Limit, the smallest object on the moon that the Hubble Space Telescope could see would be about about 320 feet. The lander is 15 feet in diameter at its largest axis. the Keck telescopes, close to the biggest telescopes on the face of the Earth now, and they were for several years, 400-inch twin binocular telescopes, 33 feet, 10 meter in diameter, each one of them. Under Dawes limit, it can resolve objects at the distance of the moon of about 78 feet, as I recall. Again, not strong enough to observe something that is only 15 feet in diameter. So the fact is, we can't see any man-made object. The question is, what about shadows? Could we not see a shadow? And it turns out that Hubble Space Telescope would have to be in orbit around the moon at a distance of 1,000 miles for it to actually resolve the landers on the surface of the moon. Here is an example of a shadow taken by the orbiter that was stayed in orbit when Apollo 11 had landed on the surface of the moon, and it snapped this picture. It didn't realize what it was doing, I don't think, but NASA scientists eventually noticed that this little object you see at the arrow is the shadow of the lunar lander that we just saw. And at a certain time of day, it was able to accentuate the shadow and see that. But that was from only a couple hundred miles up, as opposed to 240,000 miles away on planet Earth. And you can see, even from that short distance, how difficult it is even to see a shadow. Any questions on that? So, and incidentally, what are some of the other arguments that are given by those who believe the lunar landings were a hoax? Well, why don't we ever see stars in the sky in those pictures from the surface of the moon? What's the answer to that? You ever try taking a picture at noon on a sunny day of a building or a tree? I mean, what kind of time exposure do you need? Well, you may never have used a camera with time exposures, but it's going to have to be very short, right? Maybe a thousandth or a couple thousandth of a second to minimize the effect of the illumination of the sun. It's all done automatically by the point-and-shoot cameras, but that's what's happening here. This is probably a 4,000th of a second exposure because of the brilliant light of the sun reflecting straight off the surface without any reduction because of an atmosphere. And as a result, how many stars are you going to see with a 4,000th of a second exposure? Absolutely none. And what's the other argument that's often given? You know, that's one. The fact that we don't see stars in the images, the fact that we can't see the landers with large Earth-based telescopes or the Hubble Space Telescope. And the third argument is, why is the flag always sticking straight out? We know that would be impossible on the surface of the moon because there's no atmosphere, there's no wind. And what's the answer to that? It's the fact that they put a bar out that held up the flag. So they knew it was us rather than the Cubans or the Russians. So that was a big deal. Okay, any questions on that before we move on? Let's take a look at this. Two important laws relating to light. The Stefan-Boltzmann law. And the basic idea here is this, that the amount of energy that's emitted by any object is related to its temperature, and that makes sense. Hotter objects seem to have more energy emitted. But it turns out that that's a very disproportional relationship because the radiated energy is proportional to the temperature to the fourth power under this law. So, for example, if the temperature of a star doubles, the energy is 2 to the fourth power or 16 times greater. Well, what if the temperature of a star triples and it's the same size star? The energy is 3 to the fourth power or 81 times greater, more energy being produced than in the cooler star. This is the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Here's the two conclusions I think we can draw from this. Number one, slight increases in temperature produce huge increases in emitted energy. Very important point. Tiny variations in temperature have greatly magnified consequences in terms of energy. And secondly, hot stars are much more energetic and burn up faster. It's like running at 100-meter race speed for a marathon. You can't do it. You're expending too much energy. You're going to burn out and die. And that's what's happening in hot stars. They're burning up fuel too quickly. And we'll come to that story in a future chapter. But it's all a function of this law that the energy, the emitted energy, increases at such an extraordinary rate with increases in temperature to the fourth power. And the second law that I want to mention here in passing is Wien's law, named after Wilhelm Wien. And this law says that, and this is intuitive, wavelengths are associated with temperature. That if you have a hotter object, the particles in that object are, why is it hot? Because those atomic particles are moving around faster, they're more energetic, and those moving particles that are charged emit radiation. And the radiation they emit as they're hotter and hotter is higher frequency and shorter wavelength. And so that tends to be blue. Okay, whereas cooler objects, particles are not moving as fast, all right, a little more sluggish, less energetic, slower frequency, longer wavelengths, so the cooler objects tend to be red. The hotter objects tend to be blue. And it's the exact reverse if you look at the typical faucet. The blue dot refers to what? Cold water. And the red dot refers to hot. That's exactly wrong. You ought to ask the custodial crew, would you please change those faucets so they are correctly depicting temperature? The blue is hot. The red is cold. So here we see the cooler temperatures are associated with longer wavelengths, the red end of the visible light spectrum. The hotter objects are toward the blue and violet end. And we see that when we light an object in a fire, a piece of metal. You know, it gets pretty hot. It's still black, isn't it? You touch it and you burn your hand. You can't see any difference. And why is that? Because the radiation it's emitting is infrared. But as it starts to heat up to a sufficient temperature, it starts to glow orange and then red and then yellow and then white as that temperature increases. We see it in lava. And this is how we determine the temperature of stars. You know, somebody, I'm often asked, how do we know the temperature of the sun or of stars? We know their temperature by their color. It turns out that each color is associated with a specific temperature here in degrees Kelvin. If it's a perfect black body, and I'm not going to go into the details of what a black body radiator is, but that's basically an object that absorbs all radiation that impacts it and reflects none. And so the color of that black body is a perfect indicator of the temperature that it is as a result of the incoming radiation. So we see here, ideally, that the temperature of a star or a metal is going to be associated with its wavelength. And as the wavelength gets shorter, those shorter wavelengths are associated with blue or much higher peaks there in brightness. And so here we see the piece of metal that glows red. You know, it's somewhere here on the spectrum. It's approaching the red part of the spectrum. It's not exactly 4,500 degrees Kelvin. That would be about, you know, what, 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And certainly that object is not 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reason we still see it red is because it's not a perfect black body. But the concept is the same. And as far as stars are concerned, we need to consider them to be perfect black body radiators. And so this relationship here holds true, that we can tell the color of a star by looking at its wavelength. And the color will tell us what the temperature is according to these curves on this chart. And again, that's just one way of saying that temperatures are associated with colors. The hotter the object, the bluer it's going to look. The cooler the object, the redder it's going to look. And these curves are very sophisticated in informing us of what that association is. And we can tell with a high degree of accuracy using various devices, a spectrophotometer, for example, that measures wavelengths of incoming light. And the peak wavelength tells us what the color of that object is. And that's how we tell the color of stars. So you look at a star field like this, and the different colors there are a function of the temperature. And each color tells us what the temperature of that star is. So if you see an orange star, you go over here and you look at the radiation curve, and we see that it peaks in the orange or red at about 4,000 degrees Kelvin. So we know that's what the temperature of this star would be. And if we see a blue star up here, we know that that peaks at a much higher temperature, and we can correlate the temperature based on the color of the star very accurately. What about the sun? Well, it turns out that the sun is whitish yellow. That indicates that the temperature of the sun is about 5,800 degrees Kelvin, about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's not the core temperature, that's the surface temperature. The core temperature of the sun is closer to 15 million degrees Kelvin, but the surface temperature drops down to about 5,800 degrees Kelvin, and that's what makes it appear whitish yellow. Now, from this image, we see three different stars, kind of an orange one, a yellow one, our sun, and a blue one. And if we take the radiation curves here with the spectrophotometer, you can see the temperature correlated to the color based on what are called the Planck curves, the radiation curves, named after Max Planck, you know, a great German physicist who, as I recall, died in about 1946. So he survived World War II, but his son, Erwin, was executed by the Nazis, despite his father's fame, Nobel laureate, because of his involvement with the July 44 plot to assassinate Hitler, the Stauffenberg bombing. So anyway, here we see the different peaks in these curves based on the color of the star, and we're looking at the wavelengths here. So the shorter wavelengths here correlate with blue, and that correlates with the hotter temperature, in that case 18,000 degrees. Now, just to summarize a few of the key points, there's many kinds of electromagnetic radiation, from gamma rays with wavelengths the size of an atom, all the way up to those long-range radio waves we've been talking about. The different kinds of radiation are determined by what? By temperature, which corresponds to energy and frequency. The greater the temperature, the more those atomic particles are, the more quickly they're oscillating, higher frequency, smaller wavelength. High energy physics is the term used for gamma ray and ultraviolet and even X-ray astronomy with those orbiting telescopes. As the temperature of an object decreases, the electrons, it's really intuitive, are more sluggish, they're moving more slowly, they're emitting radiation of a slower frequency, a longer wavelength, for example, invisible light, infrared, or radio. All forms of radiation are produced by the motion of those charged particles that produce those self-propagating electric and magnetic fields that Maxwell talked about. That's the first topic. Now, the second topic is spectroscopy, which is related to the first topic. Isaac Newton passed white light through a prism and was able to produce the colors of the rainbow, a spectrum, a continuous spectrum, the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Why was that? Well, he determined that it was because of what's called the refractive index, that all forms of light, when they pass from one medium to another, change velocity. And the amount by which they change their velocity is based on their refractive index. And the refractive index differs based on wavelength. For red light, it's less than it is for blue light. And so coming through the other side of the medium, the red light has not been bent as much as the blue light, and the whole spectrum is dispersed and displayed on the wall. And that's what's called a continuous spectrum. Now, in the early to mid-19th century, as scientists would look at the spectrum of the sun, they began to notice that it was not exactly a continuous spectrum as you saw when you shined a light through a prism, but there were dark lines in the spectrum. And it became a very great mystery as to what these black lines were. Here's the sun spectrum. Now, keep in mind, this would actually span from here all the way over to here if we laid it out side by side. But here it's chopped up for presentation purposes so you can see the entire spectrum in a abbreviated space. But the amazing thing was all these black lines that we saw here. Newton himself had noticed these, and he felt that those black lines were the boundaries between colors. But that was not a satisfactory explanation. What are they? It was a great mystery. We see, and something else that was discovered was every star had a unique fingerprint. The black lines were different for each star that was measured with the spectroscope. And you can see that here. Look at the relatively few black lines in Procyon in the red part of the spectrum, and many more in the Sun or Arcturus, for example. So, as the 19th century closed, the dark line spectra produced by shining a light through jars of known gases produced a spectrum. And so you had people like Gustav Kirchhoff in 1860 that would put different gases in jars and shine light through them and form a spectrum. And he noticed that those lines differed based on the type of gas the light was passing through, and that each gas has its own signature or pattern of black lines. But nobody had the slightest idea what was causing this. In fact, certain types of gases and elements were discovered by looking at the sun's spectrum, including helium. It was given the name helium, referring to the sun Helios, because it was discovered by examining the spectrum of the sun and seeing black lines that didn't correspond to anything that Kirchhoff had discovered with his bottles. But again, as the 20th century dawned, nobody really could explain these mysterious lines. The answer to this question becomes one of the greatest achievements in the history of science. And it unlocks our ability to understand the data bound up in the radiation that rains down upon us from the heavens. The guy that figured this out was the Danish-American physicist Niels Bohr. Born in 1885, died in 1962. His mother was Jewish, so during the Nazi persecution, he flees to Denmark, which was under Nazi occupation. In 1943, he ends up emigrating to the United States, where he worked on the atomic bomb project. And he concluded that something is obviously blocking light from coming through that bottle of hydrogen gas, for example. This is the hydrogen spectrum. When we shine a light through a bottle of hydrogen, pure hydrogen, this is what we see. The reason we see those black lines, he deduced, was that something is blocking the light at those specific frequencies and wavelengths from getting through the bottle. He comes up with a theory that explains the dark lines, light itself, an atomic structure, what we now call the Bohr model of the atom, 1913. So we begin with Maxwell's model that those moving electrons in an atom constantly are emitting electromagnetic radiation in the form of those self-propagating electric and magnetic fields. Bohr says that according to Maxwell, those electrons in motion should be emitting radiation in the form of self-propagating electric and magnetic fields, and they should emit it continuously because those electrons are constantly moving. And as they're continually emitting this light or this radiation, they should begin to lose energy very quickly and begin to spiral down toward the nucleus of the atom, continually releasing radiation as they go in a smear, a continuum. So the question is, why do we have atoms at all? Why doesn't every atom just immediately disintegrate? How is the electron propped up continuously orbiting around the nucleus? Why are there atoms at all? Under classical Newtonian mechanics, there shouldn't be. And furthermore, we don't see a continuum of radiation at multiple wavelengths corresponding to the electrons spiraling downward, releasing energy as they go. We don't see that either. As one scientific historian said, it was one of the most audacious hypotheses ever introduced in the history of physics. Bohr conceives of the atom as a solar system with a nucleus of protons and orbits of electrons, electrons going around the nucleus of the atom. And here is the key point. This was the key thought. Electrons can only be in certain defined, what he called quantized orbits. Comes from the Latin word quantum, which means how much. Electrons can only be in certain orbits going around the nucleus of the atom. Like stairs. Stairs is a perfect analogy. Just think about it. When you go up or down a flight of stairs, and those stairs are, let's say, 8 inches tall, you can go up one stair at a time. If you're in a hurry, you can go up two stairs at a time. Maybe even three stairs at a time. But that's usually about it. The point is, you can't go up one-tenth of a stair. You can't go up a half a stair. You can't go up four-sevenths of a stair. You're limited to the stairs. It's quantized. There are only discrete levels that you can climb or descend. And Bohr said it's the same thing with electrons in an atom. They can exist at only certain levels and orbits around the center of the atom, and those orbits correspond to specific energy level. And here's another key. As long as an electron stays in its orbit, even though it's moving, it's not emitting any energy. It's not releasing any energy. It can stay in that orbit forever. It's like running around a track, 400-meter track. As long as you stay in your lane, you are releasing no energy, and you can stay in that lane and run forever. Quantum mechanics, not classical mechanics, applies to the motion of electrons around atomic nuclei. Again, quantum refers to the Latin word, which simply means how much. It's basically physics or mechanics at the atomic level is what quantum mechanics is exploring. Electrons emit radiation only when they change orbits. It's counterintuitive. How can they be in an orbit and expend zero energy forever and only emit energy in the form of radiation when they go to a higher orbit or go to a lower orbit? So Bohr theorizes that each element, each atom, has its own electron orbits with different but very specific energies. So helium has different orbits than hydrogen, and nitrogen has different orbits, and on it goes through the whole periodic table. And electrons can move to a higher or lower orbit by either absorbing or releasing a photon of the precise energy difference between its current orbit and the destination orbit. So here we have an electron in the second orbit, we'll say. It can absorb a photon of the exact energy to bump it to the next level or two levels up, and vice versa, it can release energy and descend to a next lower orbit. For example, if the second energy level corresponds in a particular atom to 10 electron volts, and the third orbit is 14 electron volts, electrons in the second orbit must absorb a photon of 4 electron volts to jump to n to the third level. And such photons have a wavelength of 657 nanometers, which are red in the visible spectrum. I'll show you an illustration of this in just a minute. So that beam of light going through that jar of hydrogen gas, countless electrons will absorb photons of light with wavelengths of exactly 657 nanometers, leaving a black line at that point on the continuous spectrum at 657 nanometers. That's the point at which the photons are absorbed by the electrons, bumping them up to a higher orbit. Electrons also absorb photons of energy needed to jump to N4 or N5, higher orbits, leaving black lines in the blue-green and blue regions of the continuous spectrums. And that accounts for those lines that we saw. All other photons pass through the hydrogen jar and produce a continuous spectrum on the wall with those black lines. Excited electrons, those that have bumped up to a higher energy level because they've absorbed a photon of the exact right frequency and wavelength to bump them to the next orbit, they cannot remain in those higher orbits long because that's a higher energy state, and they want to virtually immediately descend back down, and so they do. They instantly emit a photon of the exact amount needed to send the electron to a lower orbit and ultimately back down to the ground orbit, what's called N1. And here we see a depiction of what we're talking about. Here's the continuous spectrum. That's where you have light going through a prism, producing the spectrum. Now, if you introduce a cold gas between the light and the prism, you still end up with a continuous spectrum because you have light in the background, but you have the black absorption lines now, and that produces the absorption spectrum. Now, if the light is up here and you hit a gas and you're looking at that gas from, let's say, here through a spectroscope, you don't have a background light back here, so you're not going to see a continuous spectrum. What you're going to see here is called an emission spectrum from an object such as this, where the light comes through the gas in this direction. The photons that are bumped to a higher or lower orbit are emitted from the gas and form what's called a bright line spectrum or emission spectrum in a dark background. And astronomers see examples of this in certain types of nebulae. You see examples of absorption spectrum. These are probably the most common. You see these in stars, dust clouds, galaxies. This is what astronomers are going to see. But the bottom line is this, that through studying these spectra that are taken with a spectroscope of objects in space, and by studying these black lines, spectroscopists can determine, and now it's all done by software, the composition of that object by looking at those lines. Because again, every element and molecule is associated with its own lines. And here's an example. Again, we're looking at the hydrogen atom because it's the simplest. But even uranium is the same principle. It's just far more complicated. And if you understand this, you understand all we need to know. This is what's called the Balmer series. And this refers to a series of orbit changes that corresponds to visible light. And it all is transitions from the second energy level, not the ground level, but the second energy level of the hydrogen atom, as it absorbs different frequencies and wavelengths of photons, bumping it up to the third level requires 656 nanometers, bumping it to the fourth level requires 486. And these wavelengths are all associated with the black lines that we see in the spectrum. And here's an animation showing how this works. Here's an electron that absorbs the orange, forming a line in the orange part of the spectrum. And down here, an emission spectrum, an orange bright line is shown as well. And that's essentially how it works and forms these different lines using the most simple element of hydrogen. Now, here are examples of different elements and their characteristic lines, starting with hydrogen, and then we go to helium, oxygen, and carbon. You can see how it's becoming more complicated as there are more electrons in the element. You come down here to neon, and you see that each one of these is like its own separate fingerprint. Look at xenon down here, how complicated this is. The black lines have been transposed into bright lines here, by the way. So the point is, every element and every molecule has its own distinctive set of black lines. And when you're looking at an object such as a star or a galaxy that may have many elements in it, you start combining, let's just say, these lines together. You got a real problem on your hands of trying to extricate the contents of that object. And a trained spectroscopist can do that. But today it's done very quickly through software. And even on the amateur market, this is a spectrometer, which is probably the best one available on the amateur market, and it's $5,000. But here's the camera, and here's the prism in here, and you can actually go out and take spectra of stars and galaxies yourself. And the interesting thing is, with software that comes with that spectroscope, you can approximate the contents of the objects that you're viewing. Again, here's the sun spectrum. Now, here's the Voyager 2 spacecraft. This spacecraft, I think it's the farthest spacecraft now from Earth. It's about 12 billion miles away. So it's about three times farther than Pluto from the sun. And I think we listened to it last week, a couple weeks ago in our last class. It's still sending out that warbling messages at about 20 watts. But the interesting thing is, as a result of the work of Carl Sagan, they put a gold record on the side of that spacecraft. And we'll take a look at that in much more detail the last week of class. It has a record underneath that casing, that if you play this record, you will see many objects from planet Earth, people, animals, natural locations, scenes from nature, many sounds. And the idea is that this object, if someday, right now it's an interstellar space, if some alien civilization ever finds that record in that spacecraft, would they be able to know something about ourselves? So it's interesting to think about that subject. But, and we'll talk about that in a later chapter. Here's the record right here. And, you know, you look at that, that explains everything we want to say. And so let's say that we're the Romulan assembly here, and we've hauled this spacecraft in. We're trying to figure out what does this mean? Well, it may take us 100 years, but eventually the idea was we would figure it out. And we'll go back to this in a later chapter. But the point is this. Every element and molecule has its own unique spectral lines. Some elements, such as helium and argon, neon and krypton, etc., were discovered through spectral analysis. It's the major tool astronomers use to determine what things are made of in space. That's the reason we study this tonight. Because throughout the rest of the semester, when we talk about different objects in space, we know so much about those objects, all because of the spectra that we take with the spectroscope and look, studying those lines. Those lines tell us so much about that object, not just the composition, what it's made of, but the thickness of those lines will tell us the relative abundances of those elements and molecules in that object. They'll tell us the radial velocity of that object, if it's moving away from us or toward us, and in either case, how fast. They tell us if it's rotating. They tell us its approximate age. Just an incredible amount of data that we can unlock from these spectra, all because of the work of Niels Bohr in unlocking the meaning of those black lines. We know the sun spectrum. Based on the sun spectrum, the sun is 75% helium and 75% hydrogen and 23% helium and 2% everything else. That's important because we know that the sun's energy doesn't come from fission, for example, nuclear fission. Because if it did, there would be a whole lot more uranium in it than just a trace element. So it's amazing what we can learn through studying these spectra. Now, here's the key point. One of the key points is this, that whoever finds that Voyager spacecraft and record, I personally don't believe there's anybody out there. I believe intelligent and all life is unique to planet Earth and the entire universe. And we'll come back to that topic in chapter 21. But if there were an intelligent civilization out there that found it millions of years from now, what we now know from taking spectra of objects as far out as 12 billion light years away and as short as close as the sun, we know that the periodic table is the same everywhere in the universe. The universe is what astronomers call isotropic. It is the same everywhere. If there's a UFO that lands in the parking lot here tonight and leaves a hubcap, it's not going to be some exotic element that's never been discovered. We know what the universe is made of in the closest and the farthest objects, and it's what we see here on planet Earth. What an amazing discovery. And how do we, to think that we can look at a galaxy 10 billion light years away and know not only what it's made of, but the relative abundances of the elements and molecules in that galaxy, simply by looking at the spectrum that it produces in a spectroscope. What an amazing advancement in science. We'll return to this topic in a later chapter, in fact, the last chapter in the book. Now, the Bohr model had certain shortcomings. Yes, it wasn't perfect. Let me mention a couple. As brilliant as it was, and it did unlock the meaning of those black lines in absorption spectra, or in emission spectra for that matter, and told us all these things about the universe. But there were some shortcomings with it. Number one, It failed to explain why certain spectral lines are brighter than others. Why are they not all the same width? Why are some brighter and wider than others? Shouldn't they all be the same if they're all being absorbed or emitted? And furthermore, it treats electrons like they're atoms, actually, like they're little planets with a nucleus and all these electrons orbiting around it like planets around the sun. It's like a little solar system. And that was a very nice, tidy, and convenient theory in 1913, but it was fundamentally revised 10 years later by something called the uncertainty principle that was invented by the German scientist Werner von Heisenberg, which dictates that the position and momentum or velocity of an electron can never be determined simultaneously. This is in the realm of quantum mechanics that is so counterintuitive. Here's a picture of Bohr and Werner von Heisenberg. Here's Heisenberg, German, born in 1901. He receives the Nobel Prize in Physics when he's 30 years old for the uncertainty principle. Dies in 1976. He was a student for a time of Bohr. By the way, his doctoral dissertation, as I recall, was presented to a panel of three physicists, one of whom was Wilhelm Hertz, from whom we get the unit of measurement of Hertz in the frequency of waves. And he voted to flunk him because he felt he was too theoretical and did not know enough of classical mechanics. But the other two saw the genius in the guy, and he was. His genius was not in mechanics, but it was in theory. And he gets the doctorate, and he comes up in 1927 with this simple theory. And here is a direct quotation. "The more precisely the position is determined, the less precisely the momentum is known, and vice versa." He was referring to electrons here, based on the wave nature of light. So the delta in position times the delta, or the change in momentum, equals or exceeds Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. You don't have to remember this. Planck's constant, again, is an exceedingly low number. It's 6.6 times 10 to the minus 34 joules per second. So the bottom line is this: the uncertainty principle, because of this equation, only has meaning at the microscopic level, at the atomic level. It simply is not observable on the macro scale. It still exists on the macro scale. The essence of the theory is this: that we can never know the position of an electron going around an atom if we know its velocity or vice versa. So he determined that the position of electron has got to be viewed as what was called a probabilistic distribution, as a cloud, that an electron would be within a cloud, a quantum mechanical probabilistic distribution, somewhere in there, but we don't know where. And as it turns out, it's a radius of about 3 meters, about 10 feet, for an electron on this table. It just distorts. It's so counterintuitive to our understanding of atomic structure that reality is a function of probability. The effect of the uncertainty principle, only detectable at the atomic level, similar to the Doppler effect, which was theorized by Christian Doppler in the middle 19th century before it could be observed. And people thought he was crazy until a locomotive steam engine eventually was able to go fast enough to detect that phenomenon. He works on some nuclear fission experiments with Bohr. He's persecuted by the Nazis for accepting Einstein, what the Nazis called the Judenphysik, Jewish physics. He's eventually cleared by Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler and allowed to continue his experiments. Bohr, meanwhile, emigrates to the United States and convinces President Roosevelt to investigate Nazi nuclear physics research. He is concerned that Heisenberg, his brilliant student, was actually going to be able to develop nuclear fission before the Allies and develop a super weapon that would bring victory to the Germans in World War II. What is he up to? How advanced are they? This haunted Bohr, and he convinced FDR to do something about it. So a controversy arose over the Nazi atomic bomb progress. What exactly was happening? By the way, Hitler defunded nuclear research in 1941 because he thought the war would be over so quickly in his favor that there wasn't a need to divert money to it. And he also had this crazy view that if a nuclear fission reaction was ever started, it couldn't be stopped. And the whole world would erupt in an explosion. And he made his famous statement that I don't want to go down in history as the man who destroyed the world. So the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA back in World War II, they come up with this plan to have a secret agent infiltrate a international conference where Heisenberg was speaking in the neutral country of Switzerland, and to listen to him speak and try to gain from that speech whether the Germans were about to develop nuclear weapons. So they select a catcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team by the name of Mo Berg. They give him a gun that had one cyanide-tipped bullet. If that hit somebody anywhere, he'd die within seconds. And so Berg goes to the conference. He has this revolver under his coat. He sits there in the front row. He listens to Heisenberg give this speech in this neutral country. He listens quite attentively. Later that day, he had to give his radio report back to the OSS, and they said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I sat there and I listened to his whole speech, his whole lecture, and I didn't have the slightest idea what he was saying, so I didn't shoot him." So anyway, Heisenberg survived. It turns out that it became a great controversy. That was one of the dumbest covert operations I've ever studied. But it's interesting that after the war, there was a great controversy over how close Heisenberg was to developing nuclear fission, a nuclear weapon. It was kind of shocking to the Allies after the war, really, how far the Germans were. A guy writes a book in the 1950s, and he comes up with a theory that Heisenberg secretly did not want the Nazis to win, and he wanted them to lose, and he knew that a nuclear bomb would be the deciding. Just think if the Germans had developed nuclear weapons in 1942. We'd be speaking German today, because they were so advanced in rocketry in the manner of delivering those weapons, which the Allies were years away from doing. So if the argument was that he purposely slowed down the research to make sure that the Germans never did, you know, invent a nuclear bomb. And many people since then have rejected that and said that he just was too theoretical, too abstract to have ever actually been able to create this. That debate rages to this day. But the bottom line is, with Bohr coming here to the United States, Enrico Fermi, Albert Einstein, the reason we won World War II was because our German scientists were better than their German scientists. Anyway, so you might ask, well, why does the sun have an absorption spectrum at all? Isn't it just like a pure white light, like a flashlight that performs a continuous spectrum? Why are there black lines? The reason it has black lines is because the radiation from the sun goes through the upper atmosphere of the sun, and that's where we pick up the black lines, not from the core. All right. This is a picture of a very significant image. This is looking at the Virgo constellation of the sky. And what I want you to focus on here is, if you look closely, you will see literally hundreds, if not thousands, of little faint gray ovals in that image. Do you begin to see some of them? They're all over the place. Probably thousands in that image. But this is the Virgo galaxy cluster, sometimes called the realm of the galaxies. The question was this. When we started to develop larger aperture telescopes, you started to see these little gray ovals. And they were called spiral nebulae because they looked like spiral nebulosities. But nobody knew exactly what they were. And with the advent of photography, with long exposure photographs, countless more of these things showed up in photographic plates. You'd see things like this. What are those things? Or like this. This is a closer-up vision of the Virgo cluster. But what are these white blobs that you see all through this image? And there were two theories. Some believed, like Heber Curtis, in the famous debate in 1921 on the nature of the spiral nebulae, he believed that they were separate galaxies from our Milky Way galaxy, unimaginable distances away. Harlow Shapley from Southwest Missouri, probably the second most famous astronomer of his day in 1920, he argued that they were just clouds of hydrogen gas, essentially, in our own galaxy. And there was only one galaxy in the universe, the Milky Way. We didn't know what they were. That was in 1920. And then the answer comes from another astronomer from Southwest Missouri, Edwin Hubble. Many believe the greatest astronomer in the 20th century. Some would dispute that. He proved, and we'll look at this story in much more detail in a later chapter, he proves that these spiral nebulae were in fact galaxies. How does he do that? Because the largest one is what's called the Andromeda Galaxy, M31. He was able, with the Hooker telescope, the largest telescope in the world from 1919 to 1949, he was able to, with long exposure photographic plates, resolve individual stars in that galaxy for the first time, late 1920s. And so he conclusively resolves the issue that Heber Curtis was right. They are, in fact, other countless galaxies, just like the Milky Way galaxy. He estimated the distance was about 900,000 light years to the Andromeda galaxy. In fact, it's 2.2 million. But it still was far enough to indicate that it was a separate island of stars. Now, he also discovers that the galaxies, he took spectra of many of them, and he discovers something very unusual, that the black line spectra that he would take images of were redshifted. The vast majority of these galaxies were redshifted, meaning the lines didn't appear where they were supposed to on the continuous spectrum. They were shifted over to the long or to the red side of the spectrum. And that's called a redshifted galaxy. And what exactly does that mean? He said this, that the redshifts in the galaxies that we're observing is an indication of speed. And the greater the redshift, the faster that object is moving. And the corollary is the farther away it is from us. You know, if I would detonate a hand grenade here on this table, and we took a picture a thousandth of a second later, where would the fastest projectiles be? The farthest away. Where would the slowest projectiles be? The closer to the detonation point. That was the very analogy that he uses to show that the fastest objects with the greatest redshifts, he believed, have got to be farthest away. What does that indicate? The universe must be expanding. He resisted making that obvious conclusion because he feared that it was going to be wrong and disproved by later theorists. So I was just at Mount Wilson a few months ago where he made these groundbreaking discoveries. And I spoke for 3 hours with an 85-year-old retired astronomer that knew Hubble personally. He was a kid there when Hubble was doing his work, but his dad was a professional astronomer at the observatory. So he basically lived up there, and he knew Einstein, he knew Hubble, he knew Humason that we'll look at in a later chapter. And by the way, he did not think Hubble was that great of an astronomer. And he said Einstein, too, it made him sick. You know, he'd come to look at the telescope, the big Hooker 100-inch telescope. He'd look through the eyepiece and say, eh, I'm not interested in that, and walk away. So he was one of the 90% that looks through a telescope and says, where's my video game? He was not at all impressed looking through. So there you have a firsthand report from a guy that personally knew Albert Einstein. So anyway, he said these redshifts indicate these objects are farther away. And here's the clue, and that's the Doppler effect that we see when a train goes by. Have you ever noticed that? Listen to the pitch of the whistle. Train's approaching. They'll wonder what's going on in the next room. Run for cover. Boy, that happened to me. My right after my wife and I were married, I was in law school, and I just had to have quiet. I studied constantly, and I couldn't stand extraneous noise. So we rented this little 800-square-foot house in a town, in a small town, some miles away. And the first night we were there, about 2 o'clock in the morning, we were sound asleep, and this is what I heard. It turns out there was train tracks right across the street from where we lived. And four or five of these trains would come through town. They never even slowed down, just coming through at 70 miles an hour. The ground would shake. The room would shake. What have I done? I mean, it was just horrible. But it reminds me of that memory when I play this tape. But anyway, so what we see here as the train is approaching, here's the sound waves, and here's it stationary. As it's in motion, the forward waves are compressed, aren't they? It's coming toward us, and the pitch is higher. As it goes past us, it's gone that way. The waves coming out are stretched out. They're longer waves, resulting in a lower pitch, okay? And that's exactly what happens with sound. That is exactly, Hubble said, what happens with electromagnetic radiation, with galaxies. So here we have a stationary spectrum of a galaxy, very simplified. And here we have a blue-shifted galaxy. It's the same lines. You see that? But now they're shifted to the right, to the blue end of the spectrum. And down here, we have red-shifted. And this is where the lines are shifted to the red end of the spectrum. They're to the left. And that's a red-shifted. And he deduces that that means it's receding from us, just like the train whistle. The pitch goes down as it's going away from us, because the wavelength is expanding. And similarly, with radiation or light, as it's going away from us, it's going to stretch. It's going to stretch those waves. They're going to be longer. The wavelength's going to be increased. That's what we see in, you've heard the term, red-shifted galaxies, and that's exactly what's happening. Now, here's the key. How do we correlate this with distance? And you take the delta, the difference between the stationary lines and the red-shifted or blue-shifted lines. You use this simple equation of velocity equals the speed of light times the difference in wavelength, in the shifted wavelength, divided by the wavelength of the stationary spectrum in angstroms, and that equals the estimated velocity of that object. It turns out that's a rather complex calculation to make, and there are websites where you can plug in the data and come up with the answers, and we don't have to mess with that. But this shows a distant field of galaxies. It's the Hercules cluster, I believe. And all those little numbers you see there are the redshifts of those galaxies that have been measured spectroscopically. So here's one that's 4.5 versus this one over here that's 0.1. Here's one that's 0.4. And look at this bright one. The brighter ones tend to have the lower redshifts because they're closer to us. And since they're closer to us, they're not moving as quickly, just like with a hand grenade. The ones way at the edge of the room a thousandth of a second later, those are the fastest ones. They have the greatest redshift. And that's what we see exactly in this picture. So you look at the bright ones, look at 0.34. Look at this one. We can hardly see it, 4.24. And there may be a few exceptions to that general rule, but 4.48, this one right here. And these numbers, again, are all based on spectroscopic analysis. And this is how we correlate redshifts with velocity and velocity with distance today. It's one of the measuring sticks that is used. So what? Well, what's the relevance of understanding those spectral lines? We know what the stars and nebulae and galaxies, what the stuff in the universe is made of. What an amazing discovery. Those aren't just things that we see in a telescope like they were for hundreds of years. Galileo had no idea what he was looking at, what these things were made of. But we know that now because of the Bohr model of the atom. We know the composition of the most distant objects out to 13 billion light years away. How do we know they're 13 billion light years away? The redshift. We know there are no exotic materials in the universe, at least elements. We can estimate the quantities of each element and molecule in any object in the universe, no matter how near or far it is. What an amazing discovery. When you look at these faint galaxies, this is the Hubble Deep Field image, by the way, 250-hour exposure in the constellation Fornax, in an area of the sky in which there was hardly anything visible. And so we turned on the Hubble Space Telescope for 250 hours over the period of several months, and it resulted in this image. Thousands of galaxies show up in this tiny area of sky, no bigger than a straw diameter at arm's length. And the thing is, these are some of these galaxies, basically the smaller ones, generally, are much farther away, and you compute the redshift of them spectroscopically, and we know that, and you also compute their composition by the spectral analysis, and we know they're made of the same stuff that we see on planet Earth. They're no exotic materials. We can estimate the quantities of each element and molecule in any object in the universe by the line broadening in those spectra. It's all done by software. We know the speed of objects in space, looking at the red and blue shifts. And by the way, the reason Hubble deduces, although he didn't explicitly say this, that the universe is expanding, is because 99% of the galaxies that he obtained spectra for showed red shifts. Only a few showed blue shifts. Now, what does that mean? Again, the red shifts are the stretched out waves. That's the train that's gone past us. It's moving away from us, recessional velocity. What would the wavelengths be of a galaxy that's moving toward us? They'd be compressed. They'd be blue shifted. Hardly any blue shifted galaxies was he able to find. One of them is the Andromeda Galaxy that I mentioned a few minutes ago. It's in our local group of about 60 galaxies. And just because of the local motion, even though the galaxy cluster itself is moving away from each other, there are individual motions of galaxies within the cluster that at a particular point in time will have an approach velocity. And that's only true for a few galaxies in the universe. Everything, basically, is moving away from us. Like polka dots on an expanding balloon. Like raisins in a rising loaf of bread. Everything is getting farther and farther away. The great proof that the universe is not static, but it's expanding. So these are some of the groundbreaking discoveries just in the last several decades, unknown to previous generations of scientists. That's what makes this such an awesome time to be studying astronomy. We're so fortunate to be studying astronomy at a time such as this, where we can look at a field like this, unlike William Herschel or Galileo, and look at that and just see pretty objects. Now we look at that and say, man, I'd like to see the spectra of those objects. Think of what I can learn, what they're made of, how far away they are, how fast they're moving, the relative abundances of the elements in them, and on it goes, all because of the discoveries that we've talked about tonight, the nature of light, radiation, and I think most importantly, perhaps, the Bohr model of the atom. Key concepts: every element and molecule has a unique set of lines on emission and absorption spectra based on the photons of particular energies being emitted or absorbed as light passes through the medium. The unique lines are the equivalent of fingerprints that enable us to determine the composition of objects in space. And those fingerprints are the same no matter how far we look. Okay, any questions? Well, it may to a certain degree. You're swerving into a very deep conceptual idea there that is referred to as Olber's paradox. And the idea, named after the German physicist by the name of Olbers, you know, he said, when you think about it, why isn't the universe uniformly white everywhere we look at night? Because everywhere you look in your line of sight, there are stars. Some are farther away, but the farther away ones, there'll be more of them. And they'll fill in that space, and so the whole sky should be like a white haze at night. Astronomers didn't have an answer for that until Edwin Hubble in the 1920s showed that the universe is expanding, and that's the reason why it's not uniformly light. But you're right. With that slit, you isolate a star, there's going to be background stars behind it that may corrupt that to some degree, but it's going to be minimal. Well, is the universe expanding from one point? The basic idea is that it's like an expanding two-dimensional film of like a balloon that's being expanded. Or let's take the surface of the planet Earth. In what sense could you say, where is the center of the surface of the Earth? That's a nonsensical question. It's a two-dimensional sphere or circle, two-dimensional hollow sphere, expanding like a balloon. And so there's no center point. The whole surface is expanding uniformly. That's the current understanding of the expanding universe. So there's not a center. These are heavy topics, class. Believe me, I may have thought about them a little bit more, but I'm still, it's mind-boggling. Everything is heading away from something. That's right. But where that point is, it's not known, or it's not. You can't look to any particular point and say there it is. Well, you think about it, and we'll have. If you got to figure it out, you let me know.